can't tell you what a delight it's been to get to know both both Randy and Owen, so I'm very excited to be here in the Northeast, where there's lots of cool science and religion stuff going on. I had a request from one person here to say a little bit more about my story, just because, well, I'm a little bit unusual. You've probably figured that out at this point. I wear the green shirt to give it away. So when I was an undergraduate, I did biochemistry and comparative religion. Leonard Vanderhoop was the only person, I think, who really got that. Most of the people I ran into, they'd say, "What do you study?" "Biochemistry and comparative religion." And they'd say, "Interesting." And the conversation would stop. Leonard said, "Oh, you study alchemy." Years later, apparently I study alchemy. I got my doctorate studying the evolution of photosynthetic reaction centers in bacteria and got very involved in the NASA Astrobiology Institute, the search for life elsewhere and understanding of life here on Earth, and really got involved in big questions, largely how do we define life? And, you know, the more I looked into this question of how we define life, the more I ran into people who said, "Oh, well, that might not be a good question." And I thought, I don't care if it's a good question. It's something we care about. So how do we deal with this concept of life that seems to be very important to us and yet also seems somewhat troubling in terms of getting a handle on it philosophically or scientifically? So my goal here is going to help you all be just as confused about that subject as I am. Finding New Life, How Definitions of Life Shape Faith and Science. I want to start with this question I want to ask you. How do you use the word life? It's a magazine. Very good. Okay, how many people in the room are biologists? Here we go. How about physicists? Nice. Engineers? It's MIT, of course. Who hasn't been able to speak yet? Doctor? Astrophysicist? All right. Oh, come on, you can do better than that. Biology, what's life? You don't have to give me a formal definition, just how you use it. Yeah. Stuff that's part of this group of stuff that we are on the surface of the planet. That's actually probably my take-home message. Not at the end of this talk, but... things that replicate. Ooh, it has to be self-feeding. So you would say that embryos aren't alive because they don't feed themselves. The ability to evolve. How about if someone says they're the life of the party? Oh, I'm sorry. We're at MIT. No, seriously, you all know what that means. What does it mean? Energy. Nice. There was something else over here? Huh? It had something. Adds something. Nice. Value added. Another theme we'll come back to. So, just to get things rolling, I started off with this list here, and these are some of the common ways that we think of life. So there's this scientific notion of life. We talk about alien life, life in space, origin of life. These are all sort of concepts that we roughly know what mean, even if we can't define them well. Political, pro-life, beginning of life, life sentence. Those are all concepts that we have a pretty good grasp on and actually have a lot of power in our dialogue together about how we conceive of things. There is a popular definition, Staying Alive. Everyone familiar with that song? I actually think that's a really good example because it captures something very emotional about the way we think of the notion of life and the way we use life. Look Alive, Life of the Party, philosophical, we've got the meaning of life, quality of life, life and death. There seems to be a lot of weight here. And of course, theological. How many of you are familiar with theological uses of the word life? Oh, come on. Okay, yes. The Bible has just a few mentions of this word life. Before I forget, I'll go ahead and pass out some handouts. You could just pass those around. So, there really is some concept here, and I am going to claim that while it might not be something perfectly coherent and strictly defined, all of these ideas are related to each other, and we need to be honest with ourselves about what work we're trying to do with this word. I think particularly for those of us who are in the field of astrobiology, who get paid, not very much, but get paid to ask this question of, is there life elsewhere, and what is the origin of life? People want to know the answer to that question not abstractly, but because they're concretely attached to the question of life and what life means. So this brings us to the first definition I will share with you. I did not make this up myself, I promise. It is generally known in the field as the pornography definition. The pornography definition is, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but I know it when I see it. If you open the fridge and it's moving, it's alive. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're sort of worried about what I think of as the little green smudge problem. You know, if it has three eyes and it goes meep, then clearly we have found life. But if it's a green smudge, that could be more difficult. So anyway, this was in fact a constitutional law position on the definition of pornography for several years, and I think that it has something to do with what I will call the visceralness of the definition of life. Can I eat it, and can it eat me? I'm an evolutionary biologist. It seems like there would be strong selection for differentiating between cheeseburgers and rocks. There would be strong selection for differentiating between cheetahs and rocks. Because there really are ways that you interact with other living things that you don't interact with in terms of non-living things, unless you eat Twinkies. So, along comes Justice William Brennan. I just like to show that the lawyers do know what they're talking about. He responded to Stewart's definition of pornography by saying, none of the available formulas can reduce the vagueness to a tolerable level. And I really think that's where we are in both biology and philosophy. None of our current definitions do reduce things to a tolerable level. And the rest of my talk is going to be about various attempts and what they do and don't do for us. So, most of you are probably familiar with a presidential candidate who liked to talk about the inconvenient truth. If you go back a little bit farther, there's a very famous sociologist who said the purpose of a good teacher is to make their students familiar with inconvenient facts, inconvenient truths. So what we really want from a definition of life is not, oh, look, there it is. We want something that allows us to identify something we didn't know already. We want something that informs us when we come into new experiences. So I'm going to say that from a scientific definition of life, what we really want is something that gives us inconvenient facts, that will convince us that it's life when we don't want it to be, or convince us that it's not life when we do want it to be. And above all, will tell us what that little green smudge is. On the other hand, we have this theological question that has to do with value. And I'm going to argue that, biblically, at least, we are committed to the idea that value and life are attached concepts. And so when we're doing work with life, eternal life, bread of life, breath of life, all of these things, they're intimately tied up with the way that we do value. And so there's going to be something theologically that we want value-wise out of the definition of life, which, truth be told, is going to make it sort of difficult for us science-wise. And being Anglican, I'm going to ask both questions in the opposite way as well. I do think scientifically there is this interesting question of whether or not we can get value out of our models of the universe. I tend to think no, but there's people who are pushing against that right now, so that will be something to look at. And I do also think that any good theology will make you familiar with inconvenient facts. I'm not a big fan of bland, comforting theology. Theology should provoke you in some way, because I don't think that the world has achieved perfection yet, and one of the things we do in the church is try and push a little bit closer to that goal. So, what exactly is life in the Bible? I am going to make perhaps a slightly controversial argument here, but I think a fairly straightforward one in terms of linguistics. So I want you to set aside all of the later interpretations of the Bible and just go back with me to an analysis of the original Hebrew. Genesis begins with this wonderful concept of ruach, which is wind, breath of life, spirit, or spirit. So the first time we encounter this word is in Genesis 1:2. In the beginning there was darkness, we have a void, and there is wind over the face of the deep. Now, unfortunately, the modern translations pretty much all say wind. But if you look at the commentaries, all the commentaries say ruach means breath. It is, in fact, God breathing upon the face of the deep that has to do with this narrative in Genesis 1. Likewise, when you look at the story of Noah, there's this question of everything that has the breath of life in it. This is, once again, this word, ruach. On the other hand, if you look in Numbers 5:14, there is such a thing as a breath of jealousy. So clearly, sometimes the breath that we're talking about is not the breath of God. Sorry, it would make it much easier for my presentation if they were all the same, but they're not. The upshot of this, though, is that we have wind, breath, particularly the breath of life, we have spirit, as in a spirit of jealousy, and we have spirit that we usually have with a capital S in modern translations of the Bible. And while it's really nice in English, you can have lowercase and uppercase spirit. It's no lowercase and uppercase in Hebrew. So we're going to have to deal with the fact that all of these are in some way connected one to the other. Doesn't mean they're all exactly the same thing, but they're related. And then we have this word nephesh that's usually translated soul. And reading through a Platonic and Thomistic lens, I'll get there in a moment, people think that a soul is some seed or kernel of something that God placed in humans. But that's not what the Hebrew actually says. The Hebrew in the Old Testament has the idea of nephesh as dust that has breath in it. It never occurs on its own. It is this, there's a concept of being ensouled, but we don't get a word for just a soul. So it's nephesh hay, life with breath in it. And that is when God breathes into humans, when God breathes into animals, those are both examples of nephesh. The Greek's a little bit more complicated. You can read it through the lens of the Hebrew, or you can read it through a lens of Platonic philosophy. The Greeks at this time are doing much the same work that the Hebrews are. They've, on the one hand, got one concept. Originally, the soul, that is, the soul in Homer, is really only the thing that you lose when you die. It's what you're worried about losing when you go into battle. So there's a risk of losing your breath, and then there's whatever breath actually leaves you when you die. And slowly over the next two centuries, it takes on all of these other meanings that we're familiar with. Sort of the idea of identity, the locus of passion, the locus of choice, all of those other things get added in. And eventually, by the time we get to Aristotle, it's going to mean all of life. But here we are in the Greek New Testament. It's sort of hard to tell which exactly they're going for. But generally, we have these same two words. We have pneuma, which is wind, breath of life. It is both spirit, as in the Holy Spirit, and the spirit, as in that which enlivens us. Oh, and once again, it can also be an evil spirit. And just to make things really confusing, think about what it means to say the poor in spirit. There's one that we hear a lot, but I'm not sure we reflect on. Are these asthmatic people? Probably not what we're going for, but there is some concept there of having less breath, having less life. And likewise, we have psyche, psuche, the origin of psychology. And this, once again, means that which has breath. It occasionally gets used as a noun on its own, as it doesn't in Hebrew. There is just the soul of someone. My soul doth magnify the Lord. That's psyche. And what profit a man to gain the whole world but to lose his breath? Could just be life. The Greeks are talking about losing your life, and that's losing your breath. Or it could mean some sort of internal soul. So we have those things going on in the Bible. Just a couple fun other things going on. There's this wonderful word, I'm just not going to pronounce it right. Never mind. You familiar with giving up the ghost? You heard this expression? What does it mean? Dying. The NRSV translates, he breathed his last. And it's sort of unclear, because we can take this as an uppercase spirit, and there is one example of that, I believe, in Mark, when he commended his spirit to God. The idea is that God's spirit, which enlivened Christ, or Jesus, gives that back to God. On the other hand, you could take it just as he breathed his last, or you could say he stopped breathing. It's sort of tough to say which one of those is which. Curiously, and I suspect this is an accident, but I can't tell. Whenever good people die, they give up their spirit, and when the two, three bad people die, they give up their soul. But soul pretty much just means having breath in, so it's just curious that we find that the usage in Acts, when bad people die, Ananias and Sapphira, it's a different word. Okay. And then there's also Zoe, just so you know, that also means life. It also means it also means breath in Hebrew. Moving on, we've got Aristotle. Aristotle takes what's sort of a mess of all of these meanings in Greek, just as it is in Hebrew. What do all these things mean? And he says, well, what I really want to do is set up a systematic science, a systematic philosophy of biology. So he is going to intentionally narrow down exactly what he means by this word, psyche, by this word soul. And so he introduces three different souls. He's got his nutritive soul, which is what makes plants plants and separates them from rocks. It is the ability to grow, the ability to reproduce, the ability to take in nutrition. We have a motive or sensitive soul, which is what gives animals the power to move and to sense things. It's a little tricky. Plato suspects that there's sensation going on in plants too, but by and large, sensitive soul is associated with animals. And then there's this rational soul that gives humans the ability to reason. And he thinks that anything that has a rational soul also has a nutritive soul. Actually, he sort of thinks that your rational soul has nutritive properties. So it's unclear how this all fits together. But I am going to say, once again, that we shouldn't read this through a Platonic light. It is not that there is this particle of something that has been inserted in which gives things this power. He actually uses this word energeia, this being in process. The soul is the activity of nutrition. It is not the thing which grants the power of nutrition, for Aristotle. So it's a slightly different concept of what a soul is. Thomas Aquinas. We've moved a bit forward in history here. Are people familiar with Thomas Aquinas? Fairly big medieval Christian theologian. Maybe number two in the list of cited Christians after the Bible. He uses this word anima, which is pretty much the Latin for psuche. And it's really interesting. He does a strange thing. He talks about the rational soul, and he pretty much draws on the ideas of Plato when he's talking about the rational soul. It is immortal. It is perfect. It perceives things correctly. It has the ability of intelligence, which is not quite the same thing as reason. Intelligence for Plato and for Aquinas is the ability to see things in the realm of ideas, to perceive things perfectly, to perceive systems and universals, not to perceive concrete things. On the other hand, he maintains the sensitive and the nutritive soul, and he maintains them in humans, but he says, those are in the Aristotelian sense. Those are just activities. And this is where sort of our modern usage comes from. We think of soul the way Aquinas thinks of the rational soul. We tend to think of it in a very Platonic way these days. And the vegetable and animal souls go away. I'm going to be tracing the vegetable and animal souls because that's what I'm interested in for right now. And so by and large, we're going to stop calling them souls. And I apologize, I'm not actually giving a talk on souls. I am intending to give a talk on the definition of life. It's just that the two were completely linked together until we get to Aquinas. And even by the time you get to Descartes, you're going to find that there's this idea of animal and vegetable souls that we've forgotten. Give some thought to whether vegetables can be saved. And this whole idea of what is the active principle. Sorry, that was a joke. There we go, now some of you laugh. By soul, I really mean this active principle, and the question is how we relate that active principle to ideas of self and salvation. Aquinas has this lovely little thing. He tries to clean up Aristotle's three souls and how they're related to each other. Being a Platonist, he's happy with these ideal shapes. He says that the nutritive, motive, and rational souls are like these perfect figures. The first one's got three sides, the second one's got four sides. It's the same thing, it's just got one more side. Make sense? It's really quite straightforward until you remember that that fifth side is somehow very much different from the other four sides, which makes it a little bit confusing. For instance, sperm and eggs have vegetable and animal souls in them. But they don't get rational souls until they come together. Actually, sometime between 40 and 80 days after they come together, but that's a whole other talk. So, this fifth side is an interesting question. He justifies his distinction between the two in terms of a two-part model of creation. This is pretty much straight up Augustine. Aquinas says that there is a spiritual creation, and the spiritual creation includes archangels, angels, and humans. It's these intelligences. On the other hand, there's a corporeal creation, and that includes human bodies, animals, plants, and the rocks. And so he's very clear that these two things are created separately. Now, this gives the impression that maybe they can exist separately, and Aquinas was not entirely happy with that notion. But by and large, there's these two different parts of the world, and humans are this miraculous hybrid of the spiritual and corporeal creations. And so it's very important to him to make this distinction between the rational soul and the animal soul, because the rational soul requires a piece of spiritual creation and allows humans to participate with the divine activity in a way that the physical creation can't. Along comes the mechanical philosophy. So the mechanical philosophy is a move just before the period of the Enlightenment. And people got a little bit tired of Aquinas' dual creation. This is a radical oversimplification. I'm sorry, we only have 45 minutes. But people became skeptical of the aspects of the spiritual creation, particularly in Enlightenment Europe. There's this wondering whether intelligences, especially the intelligence that pushed planets around in circles, the intelligences that might drive things towards the center of the Earth, all of these things become somewhat dubious explanations. And so there's a refinding of the work of Lucretius, who's a Greek philosopher, who says everything in the universe is made of particles and universal forces. The mechanical philosophy claims that everything that is particles and forces. And we usually refer to this as the Newtonian universe or the billiard ball model. It's all billiard balls slamming into each other. Is everyone roughly familiar with the mechanical philosophy? This should be pretty familiar to anyone studying science in the last 500 years. Okay. Now, I am going to propose that there is an awkward patch which is necessary for the mechanical philosophy. It doesn't quite work. And indeed, Descartes and others had to do this. It can't just be billiard balls. Something had to make one of those billiard balls move, if they move at all. And so he's going to use Aristotle's idea of the unmoved mover. Early mechanists were accused of being atheists for obvious reasons. It's all just particles and forces. Where's God? Well, the mechanists say, no, God is what makes them move in the first place. You know what they say? It's even better than that. We can use the need for a pool cue as a proof of the existence of God. And the mechanists become the best friends of the theist through the design argument around the time of the Enlightenment. I think this was a really dangerous move for theology. I have some challenges there. But if you're interested in why the design arguments are so successful right now, it's because theologians hitched their wagons to the mechanical philosophy in the Enlightenment. It ends up being both the justification for the design argument today and for the atheist mechanical argument today. Both of them, I think, come from this same awkward patch on the mechanical philosophy, its particles and its forces, plus something that got the ball rolling. Now, Descartes is going to add another awkward patch. He's going to say that there is something within some of the billiard balls that allows them to move themselves. Anybody know what we call that? Not quite. Vitalism will be slightly different. The mind, or what's the most popular summary of Descartes' mind? Anybody know?
The ghost in the machine.
Possibly consciousness, that's a more complicated question. It's actually someone who's making fun of Descartes who introduces the concept of the ghost in the machine, but it sums up this idea that if everything is particles and forces, how do you sneak the ghost in? What does ghost mean, by the way? Do you remember? Breath, spirit. So it really is this nervousness about the concept of soul that we had defining life prior to the mechanic philosophy, and Descartes's going to try and sneak it in through this awkward patch of the individual mind and the unmoved mover, which becomes a really big mind because it's another initiator of motion. So here we just have a basic timeline so you can see how these relate to each other. As always, the closer we get to the present, the more detail we provide. because we seem to be going narrower and narrower in our focus. I'm sure there were wonderful things that happened in the big gaps here. I hope to discover some of them, but this is the train of thought I think we've been going on in the West. Oh, and I want to point out that particularly, put this differently. So we've got Gassendi, Descartes, and Boyle, and they're the ones who are really responsible for making the mechanic philosophy central to physics and chemistry. And that happens at this time, roughly between 1500 and 1600. Might take as late as 1700 in some branches of physics and chemistry, but that's the general idea. It doesn't, however, catch on in biology until the modern synthesis, sometime around 1930. So we've got all of these notions you might be familiar with, vitalism. We've got these notions because biology seems so wrapped up in these ideas of nutrition and motion, sensation, and occasionally reason. The mechanic philosophy just doesn't quite cut it for the biologists. And it's not until we have reductionist models via Darwin and Mendel and some particularly nice math that comes about at the end of the 20th century that people really feel comfortable adopting the mechanic philosophy in biology. So I want to really quickly go over this history that we've just traced, but in a hierarchical way, because I want to look at how we attach value in these various definitions. Now, this particular model of life in the Bible, it's not the only model of life you can draw from the Bible, but it's the one I want to highlight today, has this idea that the Spirit of God enlivens things or brings things into being, and we in fact have a four-level typology that existence requires the breath of God. In some way, motion requires the breath of God in a special way. In some way, reason requires the breath of God in a more special way, being created in the image and likeness of God. And that salvation in the New Testament, when we look at the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, once again is going to be more of the breath of God. So we've got a little bit of a challenge of how those relate to each other. But there doesn't seem to be a clear distinction between them when we're looking particularly in Genesis. Possibly in the New Testament. They seem to be different versions of the same thing. And value. There seems to be an axis here that suggests there is more value on the top. Is everyone fairly comfortable with the idea that there's more value on the top of this scale? At least at the extreme ends. God is categorically different, so the Platonist in me is not going to be entirely happy with that as a scale, but since God is the Holy Spirit, it's a little tough. Anyway, so here we've got Aristotle, we've got the activity or energeion, idea of the definition of life, and he's very clear. We've got nutrition, motion, and reason, and he's pretty happy that reason is higher up there than nutrition. Certainly it encompasses it. It is more. He's also got the prime mover on this scale. Once again, a little bit harder to tie in, but I just put it there for reference. And then we move to Aquinas, and Aquinas has his sort of Platonic notion and his sort of Aristotelian notions. And here we have existence at the bottom, and then we have nutrition and motion, and all of those fall into the corporeal creation. But you can put the intellect on top of those as part of the spiritual creation. And particularly, we've got this notion of intellect. The angels have intellect which is not corrupted by their, Aquinas says, common sense, by their physical way of processing information. And so their intellect is a little bit better than our intellect. And God is perfect intellection in a very Neoplatonic way. All of these, it's fairly clear that there's a value axis going on. And along comes the mechanic philosophy. And the mechanic philosophy generally attempts to put reason, motion, and nutrition on a scale without this spiritual creation going on, but at least in most people's minds, has this awkward patch where you have somehow inserted those two things in order to make this work for people. Any questions before we move on to attempts to make the mechanical philosophy work for biology? Yeah. At the time of the... Oh, sorry. So the question is, why this awkward patch? Who wants the awkward patch? The general answer is that in the 17th century, everybody wants the patch. They might want it for different reasons, but everybody wants it. The theist motivation is obvious. The mechanist motivation is slightly less obvious, but there are several questions that come up. There really is this idea. The reason it's called the mechanical philosophy is the idea that the universe is, in fact, mechanical. It's a big clock. And everybody knows at this time that clocks don't work unless somebody winds them up. That the energy has to come from somewhere. We can even ask this question in the modern perspective, if you ask where the energy from the Big Bang came from. Perhaps you really like brain theory and you like the idea that there are two brains in superuniversal space that collided with each other, but frankly that just begs the question of where the superuniverse came from. The question of where the first initial energy came from, what winds it up, is, I would say, the primary reason that a patch is required for the mechanical philosophy. There is a slightly more complicated reason. I mean, there's the emotional idea that we just want to understand, we want to feel empowered. But even if you don't want to feel empowered, if you are a Cartesian and you are trying to understand the world and your brain is another machine within the machine of the world, then your brain is not capable of impassively and impartially observing. And while I don't think this necessarily holds today, certainly for Enlightenment thinkers, if you get rid of the awkward patch of mind, you can't do science, because there's no privileged standpoint from which to stand and observe the universe. Yeah. No, in the mechanic philosophy, the Q can't be within the balls itself. They're just particles. I mean, do you want me to respond theologically? From a modern perspective, that's okay with me, sort of. But it begs the question, and Mulla Sadra and Thomas Aquinas will both address this, of whence the billiard table. They're rolling around on something. And so you're still going to end up needing some kind of prime mover. Personally, I'm attached to a personal God because we talk. I could be crazy, I don't know, but it seems to work for me. No, I know, but my point is that all I need for the talk today is to capture the idea that there apparently has to be something other than those particles and forces. And that's why it's introduced. And now we're going to try and get rid of them. Okay, so mechanical definite. Oh, sorry. Oh, I had a point there. What was it? Oh, yes. So I just wanted to remind you of these questions. Can we, in the modern circumstance, do without the patch? That, I think, is the big biology question. And the big theology question is, can we do without this idea of value? At least a value that springs automatically from our definition of life. So, can we have a mechanical biology? C.S. Lewis, I think, puts it very succinctly. He says, up through the Middle Ages, we thought that everything in the world had a soul, everything in the world was alive, And there were these few things that were less alive than others, and we called them machines. And everything flipped with the mechanic philosophy. Suddenly everything is a machine, and there's some of the machines that have something special that makes them something that we call life. So I'm going to ask this question, is there a particle and force definition of life? If there is, we're going to have to deal with the hard questions that Aristotle dealt with. We're going to have to deal with nutrition. How do these particles manage to acquire energy and grow? How do they turn other stuff into them, which living things seem to do? How do we deal with motion, that Cartesian question? Why do they move at all? And do they move under their own forces, or do they just move because of external inputs, which is currently the popular thing among mechanists? How do we deal with sensation and consciousness? Thomas Nagel recently wrote Mind and Cosmos. I wasn't too thrilled with the biological interpretations in there. Nonetheless, he puts his finger right on this question of how do we deal with consciousness and value under the mechanic philosophy. There's this question of purpose and function, which is pretty much how this has manifested itself in evolutionary biology. For Aristotle, there was this telos, this proper activity. And yet, for Aquinas, it had become a proper goal. And I think the goal is really what the mechanists were mostly responding to. They wanted to get rid of goals in the universe because that didn't really make sense to them. Or an end to which something should go. There's this sort of explicit value statement. And so we have to ask the question, when we say function, what do we mean? Because biological things seem to have functions. Most people are comfortable saying the function of the heart is to pump blood. And so we need to ask ourselves, by that, do we mean the proper end? Do we mean the proper goal? Do we mean the proper activity? Evolutionary biologists get really twitchy around the word purpose, but really like the word function. I find this frustrating because the dictionary seems to think they're roughly the same thing. And yet as an evolutionary biologist, I know that some of the thing that makes people uncomfortable is they tend to attach this idea of value and this idea of goal-directed behavior to purpose in a way that they don't to function. So that's what we're going to have to negotiate here. Okay, so the most popular definition currently, which is roughly mechanical, is the evolution definition. That is, systems which are capable of adaptation. Occasionally we put caveats on that. The most popular one right now is it's a chemical system capable of adaptation because people, for some reason, don't want computer viruses to be alive. Why is that? Might have something to do with how we value chemical life versus non-chemical life. Or it might be that somehow non-chemical life doesn't capture what we mean by life. But this remains sort of a philosophically open question. It's also really interesting from a detection standpoint. How long do you wait for it to have kids? As an astrobiologist, this is really tough because, you know, you don't want to set a probe down on a planet and wait for 100 years to find out whether or not something has offspring and whether those offspring adapt. It tends to be a tough sort of test to run. So it works abstractly. It might not work concretely as a test. This is commonly known as the NASA definition. Also, we hear about Darwinian replicators, and if you're interested, Carl Sagan and Joyce are the initial references. I put this here. I always show this to my students when I'm discussing adaptation. Adaptation is not about getting what you want. Adaptation is about what you get. We have very purposely scrubbed the idea of what you want out of biology in the modern sense, and so that's something we should keep our eye on. This is really more what we tend to think of these days. Camouflage, it's there for a reason. It has a function. That tends to be the way we think of adaptation these days. John, you can take me aside and correct me later if if need be, but that's generally the way I see adaptation these days. It has something to do with aspects of an organism that have proven successful in the past, and therefore, because they do certain things in a certain context, will continue to remain as long as the organism is in that context. That's all we're going for adaptation. But there are people who think that the concept of purpose and perhaps even the concept of value can be reduced to this idea, particularly Jacques Monod and more recently Daniel Dennett. The other front runner these days is what I call maintenance. It has something to do with local anentropic properties. A little bit tough from a physics standpoint, but the idea is that somehow you are locally increasing order at the expense of order elsewhere. Mechanical philosophy, there's no concept of overall entropy decreasing. It's only the idea that locally order is increasing at the expense of order elsewhere. So we have this idea of systems that somehow avoid decay to the lowest energy state. It's unclear how long they need to. This becomes a serious detection problem. What's the size of the object that it has to be? Because if you see entropy increasing over the entire environment, but decreasing locally, then what is locally? How do we define that? Generally, we talk about it in terms of metabolism when we're reaching for a definition. I still have real problems with this, largely because crystals and stars seem to fit this definition fairly well. Once again, could be an inconvenient truth. Could be that stars are just as alive as we are, but it's something that we're going to have to deal with in terms of the value question versus a mechanical definition of life. And we usually give Erwin Schrödinger, 1944, credit for phrasing this in a particularly thermodynamic way. These days we tend to see it a little bit more metabolically, but once again we have this complex and self-reinforcing system that has something to do with the maintenance of a level of complexity or a maintenance of a state of order that is higher than we would expect otherwise. Okay, I'm running towards the end, so we're going to try and summarize fairly quickly. Chemical and biochemical definitions were very popular a century to a century and a half ago. There was an idea that maybe the particles of life were just different from other particles. But starting in around 1860 and really wrapping up with the Miller-Urey experiment, this is why this is so famous, sure enough, it appears to be the same stuff. The same particles that go into life and non-life. It is carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur, and a few trace elements. So the chemical definition has pretty much gone away. There is the biochemical definition. Maybe there are certain complex arrangements of these. Particularly people looked at nucleic acids, polypeptides, carbohydrates, and sugars. Maybe these only occur in life. They don't occur outside of life. Well, unfortunately, that went away too. Starting with the Miller-Urey, but really hitting hard in the 1990s, we have found nucleic acids in meteorites, and we really don't think that life made them happen. Polypeptides is a little bit more complicated, but you can find individual peptides, and there are environments in which they will stick together. So the biochemical definition isn't really doing too well at the moment. The information definition was popular for a while. This is, in some ways, an attempt to reconstruct this Platonic notion of form, or even an Aristotelian notion of form, that there's some organization, and the nature of that organization is there. It, I think, tends to trade on confusions about complexity and order. Particularly, there's this question of, are we talking about semantic information or thermodynamic information? And I can recommend, Randy Isaac has a lovely article about the distinction between the two in Perspectives. So, if you subscribe to Perspectives, there might even be some of these out on the table. there are some current interpretations of this which try and scrub that in the appropriate way, particularly Walker Davies 2013. And if you're familiar with Teilhard de Chardin or John Haught, they're really drawing on this notion of information. I'm going to claim that from a scientific standpoint, or at least in scientific circles, information's not so popular at the moment. So by and large, this is not doing well. There's the idea of vital force. If it isn't a particle, maybe it's one of these universal forces. Henri Bergson tries to introduce this around 1900. You know, you've got gravity. Why not have a vital force? This has largely run into experimental evidence. We haven't found any cases where potential energy is being generated by something other than the four fundamental forces. And so currently, the vital force definition in science is doing very poorly. In fact, I'm going to put red around it and eventually take it off because I think it's pretty much considered a disproven hypothesis these days. So that brings us back to maintenance, which we talked a little bit before, this locally anentropic idea. We've got the adaptation definition, which historically is based on the autocatalytic definition. So any of you who are particularly interested in this, I can recommend Hagedorn and Trolland, who are some of the first people introducing it. But I also wanted to note that the idea of an RNA world, which is very popular right now, that there were these self-catalyzing RNA molecules, that's very much along this autocatalytic line. There is some chemical which is capable of supporting itself. These days, we don't usually think of life in terms of one molecule supporting itself, but a complex of molecules that are reinforcing each other in some more complicated way. So RNA world is still possible, but people are getting more skeptical about that. We're not as gung-ho about it as we were in the 1980s and 90s. Still probably the best, most concrete idea out there, but we haven't found a self-catalytic molecule yet, and that's troubling. So here we go. I want to remind you real briefly of this hierarchical comparison and how we plug value in. And to wrap things up, I just wanted to put in a scorecard. And the scorecard is my very oversimplified view of how these things work and don't work for us in the modern context. We've got this Bible breath notion of life, really good for generating value. It is really clear in that model that more spirit is better. So from a theological standpoint, yay! It doesn't actually support human exceptionalism because the idea that the human soul is substantially different or in some way individually subsistent isn't really there. That looks to be an import from Neoplatonism. So from a later Christian standpoint, this might be a little bit uncomfortable. I'm not saying you have to read the Bible this way. I'm saying this is one way of looking at the Bible. Under this model, exceptionalism becomes somewhat problematic. It's a little bit questionable how well this works for science. It's not explicitly tied in. But this heavy value makes it sort of uncomfortable from the mechanic standpoint. So we move over to Aristotle and the idea of an activity. It's sort of nice because there's not a whole lot of value there. You can take it out if you want to from Aristotle's writings. It is just the activities things undergo. But that makes it sort of hard to get value out of the model. You're going to have to get value from somewhere else. Aristotle doesn't really give you exceptionalism either. Humans are exceptional in having this rational soul, but the rational soul is also, in some ways, a higher version of the motive soul, and it's sort of hard to tell why only humans have this particular thing. Really good for science! Yay! One of the reasons it's popular. But it does beg this question of forms. I have given you a very simple version of Aristotle, which is a anti-Platonic version of Aristotle. Unfortunately, if you read Aristotle, he's not so clearly anti-Platonic. He also says that the soul is the form of the organism, and that the form is in some way inseparable and more really real than the matter to which it inheres. So it depends on which of Aristotle's works you read, whether you want to read him as a Platonist or an anti-Platonist. He generally falls into hylomorphic compounds. He says we are both matter and form. We are both body and soul, and they never occur separately. So once you insert form in again, you get a little bit more value out, but you get a little bit less positive from the scientific standpoint. So we come to Aquinas, really good for value, really good for exceptionalism. It's actually pretty good for science. Aquinas is really into natural theology and the idea that we can observe the natural world in order to do things, and he's happy with the natural world being, the corporeal creation and obeying laws, just so long as you're willing to introduce dualism and the two creations. Most of us are sort of uncomfortable with dualism. Aquinas is not strictly a dualist. Once again, I have to put in a caveat. If you want to talk details about how Aquinas attempts to avoid actually being a dualist, we can talk about that. But simple sketch. We've got the mechanic philosophy. Value's been scrubbed out. Human exceptionalism has been scrubbed out. Really, really great for science. But stars and computer viruses might be alive. And so this distinction between life and non-life becomes really hard. And we're still struggling with exactly what we want out of a definition of life. You can stick the patch in and get some of that stuff back, but once again, you're stuck with dualism, and most people in science don't like dualism. Most people in theology don't like dualism. It just has problems. If we go for the adaptation model, I am going to say that the general public will assume that scientists and theologians are perfect, and they never make mistakes philosophically. But the general public, when they read the theologians and scientists, they're going to want to sneak value back in. And so we need to be, at the very least, prepared for how they want to sneak value back in. In particular, if we look at the adaptation as life model, if people want to stick in life as value, they're going to wonder, does value equal success? We don't really want to equate adaptation and value. But people really, for some reason, want to take that out of evolutionary biology. So we need to watch out. Along the same lines, is evolution progress? And is competition evil? You could actually have adaptation be good, as long as you don't make competition evil. But most of us don't really like the suffering that comes from competition. And so that doesn't seem to be a way out. On the other hand, we've got maintenance, this sort of anti-entropic definition. It begs the question of, is life futile? The Onion article, the Onion put it very well. I refuse to believe in a God who would allow heat death to occur. If we're really setting up the universe in a way that life is fighting against entropy, and we know from a physical standpoint that entropy is going to win, we've got problems. And I think that tends to a certain dualism. And it also begs this question of individuality. If you've got all this energy flowing around different ways, the bounding question is not just a physical question. It is, in fact, a theological and a personal question. How do I distinguish between myself and the rest of the universe? Okay. And this is just a quick sum up. I want to thank the John Templeton Foundation, David Haig in the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology, Thea Keith Lucas, and the Lutheran Episcopal Ministry here at MIT. And if you want to know more, here is my information. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now we've got another hour for discussion, or as long as you want to stay. But before we gather, let's open it up and take some questions. And since we're recording it, if you could repeat any questions.
Okay, so I will try and sum up briefly. So the first question was about the Miller-Urey experiment. And so remember that in the 19th century, we were still curious about whether different stuff made up life and non-life. And we discovered that the same elements made up life and non-life, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. That's roughly 95 to 99% of us. So the next question was, well, is there a biochemical difference? Do we find chemicals in life that we don't find in non-life? And Miller-Urey was one of the famous experiments because they particularly looked at this question of, in an early Earth environment, to the best that we can reconstruct an early Earth environment, would we expect these chemicals to come about by abiological processes? And surely enough, when they put nitrogen compounds in a reducing atmosphere and ran electricity through it, they found that basic molecules, I believe we're talking about amino acids, that these are generated under that environment. On the one hand, Miller-Urey has become slightly weaker because we don't believe that the initial environment had the same chemical makeup now that we did then. But on the other hand, we know of a whole lot more abiological processes. And as I mentioned with the meteorites, we're basically completely confident within the chemistry community that you can get biological molecules by abiological processes. Does that answer the first question? I would say for roughly the last 120 years, we've been saying within the next 20 years, we will make significant progress on the origin of life by making it in the lab. And for the last 120 years, we haven't quite made it. So at the time of Miller-Urey, that was proclaimed, we're almost there. Oh no, tons has been done on that front. It's just that we haven't actually gotten to anything that is autocatalytic or capable of self-maintenance in a way that we would call it life. So we know more. We know more about the abiological world, and we know more about the biological world. It's not entirely clear that they've gotten closer together. I generally put it this way. We have been to one planet and it's got life on it. So 100% of planets have life. Alternatively, we have sent robots to... Just make sure I still got this right. We'll say we've sent robots to seven planets. And only one of them has life, so that means one in seven planets has life. The upshot of this is if you've had any statistics, we don't have enough data yet. We're more confident than we used to be because we know there's lots and lots of planets out there. But we still don't know what the likelihood of finding life on a planet is. John. To be honest, I sat down and started looking at the word life in the Bible, and from my perspective at least, it's almost 100% of the time inserted to indicate value. And so I said to myself, oh, that's the theological work that people seem to be doing with this word. Once I did that, and I came back to the biology, I said, oh, this seems to me why people are having so much trouble. It's because people are trying implicitly and explicitly to insert the value into biology. I honestly, you know, I have two more years. I'm hoping I'll know a lot more in the future. But I honestly think this is where we're running into trouble. With the word purpose, with the differentiation between stars and organisms, I think this is why Minode is trying so hard. I think this is why Dennett is trying so hard, is that they see a way out of the value problem within the mechanic philosophy. And I'm not convinced they've actually found one. But I think it's an interesting question. And I think it's worth exploring, but I think it needs to be explored in the open. That is to say, I don't think we can just assume the mechanical philosophy is true and ask, if the mechanical philosophy is true, where does value come from? I think we have to ask, what do we want out of the mechanical philosophy? What do we want out of value? And is it possible to get them both at the same time? Yes. Sorry, thank you. No, I think Ian very compellingly argued that the mechanical philosophy, in the strict sense that it is constructed by Gassendi and by Descartes, presumes that the universe is made of particles and universal forces and nothing else, that physics, in fact, moves from a mechanical philosophy to what would better be called a mathematical philosophy. In the 17th century, and that he moves even further away in the 19th and 20th century to a philosophy which is based upon fields. At this level, I completely agree with you. If I was talking to philosophers of science, I would definitely say the mechanic philosophy was irrevocably broken by the beginning of the 20th century. That said, at a popular level, and even at an intuitive level among physicists, I don't think there's anyone out there who's going to argue with me that the standard model of physics is correct, and that the standard model of physics involves, what, roughly 12 particles and 4 basic forces. I mean, it's true we conceive of them in terms of fields, but from an ontological perspective, when you ask what we reduce things to, we still call them particles and forces. And I think, on the other hand, there's this very interesting phenomenon. I'll just be judgmental for a second, so I'll preface this by saying I'm being slightly judgmental. I think there are a lot of physics fanboys out there in chemistry and biology who presume that there is a physics which is more philosophically consistent than any of the physicists think it is. And consequently, there is a very strong tendency among apologists in biology and chemistry to claim that their field is in theory reducible to a physics which is in fact philosophically simple. I won't name any names, but there are people within the zip code who probably come to mind. Brilliant people, people I respect greatly. Nonetheless, I think it's important here to distinguish between high-level theoretical philosophy of physics, which I completely agree has moved past, and the personal worldview construction which is attached to it, which among the general public is still largely in the mechanic philosophy, and I think even among scientists tends there because it's comfortable. Is that okay? Thanks. I will bear that in mind. I'll still be really surprised if I push back and they say, no, we don't really believe in 12 basic particles and 4 basic forces. Think. Oh, yeah. So the question is, am I coming at this from the biologist perspective? And the honest answer, of course, is yes, I'm trained in biology. My attempt is actually to deal with the overarching worldview construction question that I think everyone is dealing with. And so I'm trying to use the most common landmarks I think are available in worldview construction. And I don't think that the majority of the world has gotten around to late 20th century physics yet. Nor do I think that the late 20th century physicists have a concrete notion of what is going to replace the mechanical philosophy. I think the philosophical question of what physical probabilism actually entails is one that we're not real comfortable with yet. As far as I know, the Copenhagen interpretation has won, which means that by and large people like to identify with the Copenhagen interpretation but continue to interpret it in a number of different ways. Yes. The strongest argument I have found for the necessity of mind, a Cartesian type of mind, for science can be found in Erwin Schrödinger's Mind and Matter. I have discovered, much to my dismay, that most of my friends don't get it. So I don't know that I can recommend that to others. I think Alvin Plantinga makes a very good argument based on the work of Berkeley, among others, for this position. Unfortunately, he then follows up with some other epistemologies of which I am quite skeptical. So those would be my arguments in that direction. On the other hand, a fellow in Poland, actually, by the name of Konrad Talmont-Kaminski, has written a book about evolutionary models for coming to have confidence about the physical world. Peter Godfrey Smith also has some nice arguments about how a complex external universe could bring about a complex internal state within a modern biological, modern physical notion. So those are the places I'd go for the strongest arguments right now. My own position is that on my physicalist days, I think there is a strong argument for an evolutionary basis for generating confidence about the world, which roughly corresponds to the world. I note, however, that while this in general should select for an accurate representation of the world, when push comes to shove, it's going to have to select for what everything else selects for, fitness. And looking concretely at what produces fitness, modern scientific rationalism is not there. PhDs, at least in the United States, do not do well for giving you children. This leads me to believe that the strictly naturalist position is not going to get me truth, even though it will get me some very, very useful things. And as long as I'm willing just to have very, very useful things, I'm good. With the caveat that the very, very useful things might not include science. It's sort of painful. So, if you ask the philosopher and the theologian in me, they will tell you, at the end of the day, you need something like a mind or a soul if you want to judge people who think there's such a thing as a mind or a soul. And I don't know entirely where I fall on that question. I have to be in between. I am going to do absolutely the best that I can epistemologically, and usually that involves some concept of absolute truth and some concept of mind. One of my favorite responses to that question comes from a fellow by the name of Guy Consolmagno, who's the curator of meteorites at the Vatican Observatory. What a great job. He's also a really funny guy. He says, I don't care how many tentacles it has. If it asks, I'll baptize it. The scientist in me is perfectly happy to have a definition of life that includes robots. I want a definition of life that gives me inconvenient facts. I want something that reveals something about the universe that I didn't know, or at least something about my presuppositions that I didn't know. As a theologian, it really does come down to this question of, can I have a conversation with it? Can it have a relationship with God? And yeah, I don't care how many tentacles it has. No. I usually try and avoid that trap. I'm trying to stick with vegetative souls and avoid rational souls, just because I only have so much time. But I do think that this value question goes all the way through. I'm actually leaning towards what I call the biblical model right now, which is to say that insofar as bacteria are alive, they must have some spirit in them. insofar as rocks exist, they must have some spirit in them, which means that I have ethical obligations to bacteria and rocks. I strongly suspect, or at least am more aware, of more life of some sort, more spirit, in humans than bacteria and rocks, so I tend to treat humans better. I hope I'm not mistaken, but it seems like a safe ethical starting point. Indeed, a Buddhist teacher I know was once asked whether trees are sentient. And he said, no, but sometimes sentients are trees. I really see no reason that we need to have an absolute difference between our ethical obligations to humans and our ethical obligations to other living things. I'm comfortable with the idea that humans are very like us, therefore we are very good at figuring out what is good for them, therefore we have very strong obligations to them, and bacteria are sort of like us, so we're sort of good at figuring out what's good for them, therefore we have some small ethical obligations towards them. That sounds like a trivial question, but it turns out I am betting. I won't put too much money because I don't actually bet, but I would strongly suggest that within the next 30 years there will be a debate in space law that will have to do with the competing interests of eminent domain and the right of capitalists to acquire extraterrestrial bodies, and an environmentalist-type movement that will say that any existence of microbes, even, on these bodies gives those microbes a certain amount of rights that should not be taken away by eminent domains. This, believe it or not, is currently the way the planetary protection system works. It's not constructed as the rights of the bacteria. It is instead constructed as, I believe, what do we call it? I'm sorry, I don't remember the technical language right now, but basically treasures of mankind. We consider that it would be inappropriate to biologically pollute Mars. And we spend, well, not in the national budget, but within NASA's budget, a reasonable amount of money ensuring that we do not transmit bacteria to Mars. I actually think all of these are continuous. What I'm claiming is that we have an implicit identification between the two. And my goal is to make the identification explicit to decide whether we want it or not. I'm sorry. Randy asked whether I believe that life is in fact a binary. And I genuinely think that we are doing ourselves a disservice by making life a binary, particularly in terms of origin of life, because if life is a binary and we're looking for an origin, it's going to have to happen miraculously because there's no intermediate steps. It just is or isn't. So I do think we're going to have to somehow get out of life as a binary, and yet I don't have a really good argument for that. Within the evolutionary model, there have been attempts for an intermediate stage, which I would call automata, things that are capable of replicating themselves, but only replicating in a small number of... Sorry. There's a problem within evolutionary biology with things that replicate themselves too well. The reason we don't consider crystals life despite my earlier glib remarks, is more along the lines of when material is added to a crystal, it can only be added in a small number of ways. Because it can only be added in a small number of ways, there isn't sufficient variation and inheritance of that variation, which allows for the process of natural selection, which allows for the adaptation that we're looking for. So I do think, in fact, there are possibilities for a continuous evolutionary model that has to do with replication with low levels of variation. The anti-entropic model is a little bit more complicated, but I think it has largely to do with our bounding issues, and that is a problem in the way we interpret things, not a statement about the way the universe is. And so we will probably construct an unnatural threshold at some point if we go with a maintenance model that says some duration of organization or some level of complexity is there. You know, has anyone heard of the beggar paradox? So if you give a beggar a penny, do they become a rich man? No. So if you give the beggar another penny, do they become a rich man? If you give the beggar a billion pennies, do they become a rich man? No, because they have to hire someone to haul them. But the idea is that there is this incremental process. And we do have a lot of definitions like bald and hirsute, and we're perfectly happy with the idea that that is not a natural category. There isn't a perfect line that divides it from other things. In biology, we've pretty much gotten past the whole question of species. It's a lovely, useful concept, which nonetheless does not appear to correspond to a natural category. That's okay. It's useful. And it's possible that our definition of life will likewise be something that, it's useful. I think a lot of people would be really dissatisfied with that answer, and I want to figure out exactly why. But I think we need to be transparent about that. And one of my pet peeves, actually I shouldn't say this is a pet peeve, I think it's a useful way of doing it, just one of my cautionary tales. There is a wonderful biological concept of altruism, which is all about how you can get behavior that appears altruistic but isn't. Biological altruism is a definition of altruism which excludes the philosophical concept of altruism. I will be very upset if we come up with a biological definition of life which intentionally excludes the common sense definition of life. If we do that, we should come up with a different name. And this sounds like a very abstract philosophical question. I want to make the concrete question. We use the word life on a daily basis. How can we use it in a way that makes us know more about the world than we did before? So Owen has made this wonderful argument. He says, did you say 90%? 90% of the cells in our body are not human cells. They're stuff that lives on humans. We're an ecosystem. And the question is, when we die, I'm going to rephrase this slightly, can we be resurrected without the entire ecosystem? I am very much a believer in resurrection in the flesh. And I hadn't thought of it this way before, but now I have to ask if all of my bacteria are going to come with me. Oh, are we not? I think that's another mistake. Not you. I think Owen phrased it wonderfully. Everyone likes to ask about when life starts for humans. I am perfectly happy with egg and sperm being alive. They're not individuals. That's an individualism question. And if you make the soul something that belongs to individuals, rather than a property of life, as Genesis and Aristotle have it, then that becomes a real problem. So we're not just asking the question of life from non-life. That's the question my research deals with. That's the question I'm most interested in, just because you can only ask so much at once. But there is a parallel question that has to do with individualism and whether we think that being alive means in some sense being a unitary being. And once we get to Aquinas, and once we get to Descartes, we are faced with the idea that at the very least, a rational being is a unitary being that has a discrete, unitary soul. Surprise, surprise, our atomism, which took over in terms of particles in the mechanic philosophy, has also taken over in terms of souls. It has a longer tradition, don't get me wrong. I'd be happy to talk more about Augustine at some time and his idea of unitary souls. Although even Augustine flirts with Traducianism. He thinks parents' souls break off little pieces that go to form their children's souls. So they're not quite as unitary as they become. Anyway, yes, I think this is a real question that we have to ask in terms of our relationship between our souls and our bodies, whether we're just willing to admit our human DNA cells or whether we're willing to admit that all of our cells are part of ourselves. John. So John has suggested that we don't need a definition of life. There is such thing as open-ended exploration, and isn't that wonderful? First of all, okay. Again, I'm going to agree in principle, but I'm going to push back in two concrete ways. The first way is that in order for astrobiology to be a science that is actually related to life elsewhere, it's going to have to make some commitments about experiments that would convince us about life elsewhere. It seems a necessary step. The more important thing from my perspective is people actually pay astrobiologists to do stuff. I suspect people largely pay astrobiologists to do stuff because there's something about life that they care about that they would be interested in finding it elsewhere. And so while the scientific question is open, the practical question is not. Carol Cleland is probably the most prominent. Carol Cleland is pretty much the philosopher of astrobiology. She has claimed that we're just not going to have a definition of life until we get a paradigm shift, and we should give up until then. That a sample size of one is not enough. And I'm not convinced that's true. I really think that there is something we care about, and at least as a theologian, I want to know what it is. We can't ask the question, maybe, what it is abstractly, but we can ask the question of what it is that makes it a question worth asking. And that, I think, can at least direct the science towards useful areas.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And bartender will still be here for another hour, I guess. But take your time. Take advantage of the complimentary soft drinks and the reasonably priced beer. Just to remind you of a few things, the cost of the facility is $100 and the snacks, and we'd like to cover it. So there's a little basket out there. If you could help us out, that would be greatly appreciated. Also, would like any feedback, any suggestions of kind of other speakers, other topics you'd like to have covered, please send it to me. And there are a few of us who kind of keep on the lookout for it. Some of you want to volunteer, that would be great. in different things. But overall, thank you for coming, and thank you, Lucas, for a stimulating discussion.